your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit insurekidsnow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, a contributor to the Bulwark, a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center, and counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments. And I'm joined by my colleague in all things strategery, Elliot Cohen, Professor Emeritus of Strategy at the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies and a contributing writer to The Atlantic. Elliot, how are you?
Eric, I'm doing very well, thanks. I think it's my turn this week to begin with our mandatory jackassery of the week. As always, it's a very target-rich environment. The one that I was going to begin with, well, I guess I will begin with, is Jim Clapper, who you know, retired three-star general, I believe, 50-year career in intelligence, a man of enormous integrity and capacity. Now, I think about 84, donated a dog to the CIA's canine program for detecting explosives and stuff like that. And she passed through the training, and they have a graduation ceremony. And General Clapper was looking forward to visiting. And then the White House found out about it, and they kicked him off the invite list, which just tells you what a bunch of kind of petty people these are. The possibly more serious jackassery may wish to comment on is this flurry of tweets or whatever they are in Truth Social by President Trump, reposting videos of President Obama being dragged out of the White House, accused of treason and so forth. These are all kind of fakes. But it's on the one hand just ridiculous, but on the other hand, it is sort of an indication of a disordered mind. I don't know if you have a comment on that.
Yeah, no, I very much agree with that. I mean, unfortunately for President Trump, due to a Supreme Court decision that he provoked, any official act by a president in office has been deemed by the Supreme Court to be immune from prosecution. So whatever he alleges President Obama did would be covered by that. Moreover, I mean, all of this is nonsense. I mean, the report that was put out by the Director of National Intelligence, Tulsi Gabbard, that suggests that there was no Russian interference. This is all, as our Bulwark colleague, Kathy Young, has demonstrated in the pages of the Bulwark or on the Bulwark website. We don't have pages anymore. This is all intellectual sleight of hand. I mean, she uses interference with the actual election machines as a surrogate for what really the real Russian interference, which was also recognized, obviously, by the Senate Intelligence Committee that investigated this, co-chaired by the current National Security Advisor and Secretary of State Marco Rubio. So this is all a farrago of nonsense. But I would say, when it comes to a disordered mind, that the president using the term treason in regard to his predecessor, which carries with it the death penalty, obviously, as a punishment, is an indication of the depths of how disordered his mind is.
Yeah.
But we have more serious subjects to discuss, which we are very lucky to have as a guest today, Karen Elliott House. Karen is a distinguished journalist for many, many years with the Wall Street Journal. She was the president of Dow Jones International and the publisher of the Wall Street Journal. And more to the point today, she is the author of The Man Who Would Be King, Mohammed bin Salman and the Future of Saudi Arabia. Karen, welcome to Shield of the Republic. It's great to have you.
I'll try to make sure I don't have a disordered mind while we talk today.
you're the perfect person to write this book. You've been going to the kingdom for many, many years, have interviewed all of the kings, going back to at least a King Fahad, if I'm not mistaken, maybe even before that. maybe King Khaled, I'm not sure, but you're perfectly positioned to sort of describe what you do in the current book, which is the sort of unlikely rise of MBS to become crown prince and heir apparent to his father, King Salman. Tell us a little bit about how this happened, how he managed to accumulate all this power in very un-Saudi-like ways.
Yeah, when his father became king, on the day they were mourning King Abdullah, he was reorganizing his father's government. And Saudis would say, "We don't know him. Who is he? How did he get there?" And apparently he, through most of his life, his mother was urging him, "Don't be an also-ran to your father's first wife's boys, you know, get out there and do something." And he says, people say he was his father's favorite. He says that's not true. And he lists four of his brothers that the father thought more of. But what apparently gave him the opportunity to really bond with his father was the death of Salman's first two boys by the first wife, who died within a year of each other of heart problems. And the grieving father, his older boys were busy with their families, and MBS was like 17, and he began to stick with his father. And he told me, you know, I always look for something to accomplish. And when I accomplish that, I look for the next thing. I think he was always more ambitious than many of his royal cousins. And he had a sort of chip on his shoulder, I think, which also helped motivate him, that he got $500 a week allowance, and many of his royal cousins got $5,000 a week. I would have been happy with $500. I ironed shirts at 20 cents a shirt to get money, so I was impressed with his allowance. But but anyway, he stuck close to his father, and when his father became king, he simply let his son, first son by the third wife, but his sixth son in order of all of his boys, help him run things, because the king was already 80 and his son was 29, 30. So he had all of these ideas that he wanted to do, and his father seems to have let him do them, and he's done them in a big hurry.
You know, you describe, it's a fascinating picture of somebody who's decisive, energetic, ruthless, moving quite quickly. I haven't visited the kingdom much, but I try to follow it. And even so, I was stunned by the magnitude of the changes that you describe, and also the magnitude of the ambitions in terms of, you know, literally the things he wants to build, this brand new city called Neom, but much more than that. So I was wondering if you could discuss those, the changes that you already see as somebody who's a repeat visitor to the kingdom, and that you felt in the visits that you did while working on this book, but also the magnitude of the vision that he has and how far along they've gotten in trying to implement it.
Yeah, well, he, on the changes, I've been going there since 1978. And in like 1980, the royal family was fearful of being overthrown by religious fundamentalists, so they gave them all kinds of power to control and put strictures on the population. And so when one goes there now, this shocked me the first time I experienced it in probably 2017. You walk into a hotel, and there is a Saudi man and woman standing side by side behind the check-in counter. They're not brother and sister. They're not husband and wife. They would have been jailed, you know, pre-MBS. And you used to go to a hotel and there were Lebanese men and the token Saudi behind the desk, Saudi man. So it's, and you see women strolling the streets, looking happy and relaxed instead of, you know, looking over their shoulder to see if the religious policeman is going to come with his stick and, as they did to me, whack your calves, you know, because they're exposed. I never did that again. I was wearing a long skirt, but it wasn't long enough. You know, so it has dramatically changed. He gave to encourage young people, and 65% of the population is under 30, to get young people to buy into, you're going to have to support yourself. The government's not going to support you cradle to grave anymore. He did the things that were easy to do, so to speak. The cultural changes, letting women drive, letting women work, freeing people to have fun, dance in the streets, you know, music in every restaurant now. And music was totally forbidden in the religious dominant days. And that also, I think, helps to make it a more acceptable to foreigners who want to work and try to help him achieve these goals. They're not willing to live in a place where, you know, their wife can't work or drive, or and a woman won't go there to work if she can't drive and have a normal life. So he's totally, totally changed the economy and the social life. Political freedom has become even more repressed. He does not want criticism. Your second part was all these things he's trying to do.
Yeah, the you know, particularly some of the building projects, which is neon. You know, I don't know how many times larger than New York City. And
Saudi Arabia is the world's largest construction site now, which is amazing. But this city that they are building in Neom called The Line, I mean, it's hard to even envision it, but 100 miles long. So from New York to Philadelphia, and as tall as the Empire State Building, you know, all the way. And you're supposed to be, it's carbon free, car free. You can get anything you need within 5 minutes, but it has not gone very well. And they now have hired consultants to look at whether it is feasible and whether how they should change it, maybe, because now instead of having, they're going to have only a mile and a half of that built by 2030. So way, way under what it's supposed to be. And this was his pet project. As people say who know him, he talked to me about he still plays video games. And he grew up playing video games because under the religious strictures, there was really no entertainment. So kids like he, you know, played video games, and that his friends say he grew up thinking that anything you could do in a video game, you could do in real life. So maybe that's where things like The Line, that massive city that was supposed to house 9 million people, but it may have 300,000 at the current rate, come from. I don't know.
Lowe's knows how to get you ready for holiday hosting with up to 35% off select home decor. And get up to 35% off select major appliances. Plus, members get free delivery, haulaway, basic installation, parts, and a 2-year Lowe's protection plan when you spend $2,500 or more on select LG major appliances. Valid through 10-1. Member offer excludes Massachusetts, Maryland, Wisconsin, New Jersey, and Florida. Installed by independent contractors. Exclusions apply. See Lowe's.com for more details.
This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Karen, before we talk a little bit about the forces of resistance, just to expatiate a little bit more on the changes. I mean, one of the things you talk about, Elliot touched on, was the role of women being expanded. I mean, and the percentage of women in the workforce is dramatically different. I mean, I haven't been to the kingdom in like 17 years. And I remember when I was going there in the Bush 43 administration, I used to call it the planet of no women, because you would hardly ever see a woman, out on the street. Now they're a much larger part of the workforce. And another point you make is that they're better educated in some ways than their male counterparts, because they all studied to be teachers, which was the only profession open to women really in the kingdom. And so they have more transferable skills than a lot of the men, who essentially would major in Islamic studies and who then would go on to a government, what we would call in the United States a no-show job, where you don't really have to produce much of anything. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, it is really fascinating to me, because women, when I was doing my first book between 2006 and 2012, women then were 58% of university graduates, and there was nothing they could do, as you say, except teach. So there was a lot of pent-up frustration, and releasing that, they have gone in droves to the workforce. The first of his Vision 2030 goals that was met was getting the percentage of the labor participation by women from 22% to 30% was the goal by 2030. They got from 22% to 37% by 2022. So women rushed in to work. When you go in a private company or a government office now, men and women are crowding onto the elevator, unaware that there's anything wrong with this. I mean, there isn't anymore, but I knew a lot of men who wouldn't get on an elevator with a woman. They were so afraid of being, in the old days, being accused of something. But now they all crowd on. They work together. You see young people sitting in Starbucks, boys and teenagers, older kids, drinking coffee just like here. And women provided, I think, a big spur to the economic growth that occurred in the early years of Vision 2030 that he unveiled in 2016, because they are educated, motivated, and every employer I talk to says, I would rather hire a woman. Because they will show up at 8:00, they will take any kind of training you ask, and that their male counterparts say, well, I got to take my kids to school. How about 9:00? And they just don't have the same motivation. And indeed, there are men now that talk about, is it fair, that it's harder to get a job now because they're competing with a lot of smart women.
So can I use that to ask a question that I found myself wondering about? I can certainly understand how all these changes are tremendously attractive to educated women. I'm sure they're probably very attractive as well to educated men or some middle-class aspirational men, who maybe some of those who've had more contact with the outside world. But, you know, I found myself thinking about, well, what about all the oppositional forces, which, you know, first, the, you know, the old, the Mutawin, you know, the religious police you were talking about, who are out there. And of course, behind them, an array of fundamentalist religious leaders. You know, you describe how he's basically built a sort of a dynasty around the Salman family. This is the total royal family is what, like 15,000 members of the family, and they can't be entirely happy about that, particularly if he's taking away their allowances and making them work. And then, you know, I would suspect that there's a class of Saudi men who are perhaps not particularly well educated, who are used to being on the dole one way or another, at least having the government take care of them, who have to be unhappy with this and feel, you know, displaced by women, which, you know, we've seen that in other societies. So how could you, just talking about each of those three forces, is it a sure thing that he's going to be able to survive them, or are they going to kind of leap out of the from behind the curtain?
That's a $64,000 question, Elliot. My view is, and you never know. I mean, I'll be the first to say that I did not pick him out. I mean, I advocated in my first book that they were going to wind up like the old Soviet Union with one old man after another until the place crashed. And what do you know? Salman brought in a 29-year-old and is trying to make that generational change. He now has eliminated most of the potential institutional threats. He controls the defense, his brother does, but, you know, he does. The National Guard was run by one of King Abdullah's sons. He put him in the Ritz-Carlton and took that position away. And he runs the interior forces because he fired the Crown Prince Mohammed bin Nayef, who had led interior, and replaced him. There were royals who used to say, you know, we'll get him when his father dies. But they don't say that to me anymore. Now, whether that's because they don't believe it or they are fearful of saying it, I don't know, because people don't talk to you the way they used to. You know, people don't want a cell phone anywhere around. They take you out and walk in their garden or walk somewhere where, you know, there's not what they regard as ears listening, but nobody is. The assumption is that everything you say or do is listened to. And, you know, he has, the Crown Prince has jailed a lot of the religious and a lot of other people to intimidate people into silence, so that, you know, silence doesn't mean consent, as we sometimes say. So it's very hard to know. I tend to think he controls enough of the levers of power and has enough intimidation on people that he has to make a mistake to rally the religious and the royals together. But clearly there are royals and there are religious who are waiting for that moment. How they communicate, and, you know, it's not possible for me to know, or I think anybody else, but I, you know, they know they're all listened to. So it remains to be seen. I think, you know, when he talks about, he has been very outspoken about wanting to recognize Israel and create a corridor of high tech from Saudi through Israel. And and attract foreign technology companies, a Silicon Valley and Naom around that area of the line. But if he has said very clearly since the Gaza war, I will not recognize Israel without a Palestinian state with Jerusalem, East Jerusalem, as its capital. And I think, you know, he can do anything he wants, and those around him say we can't put off what's good for us forever. Saudi first is our policy. But I think, you know, it does cause him pause, because 95% of Saudis, according to polls, say they don't want the country to recognize Israel. So a disgruntled person, it's hazardous to his health to do it, or it could be the kind of spark that, you know, brought people out to at least try to change the succession. But he is clearly hoping to create a new, not the line of the old man and all of his sons and that broader royal family, but just Salman and him and on down to his children and their children. But there are lots of royal princes who, not lots, but dozens, who think they should be, they should have a potential ruling role.
Karen, I mean, one thing that you talk about in the book a lot is the effort he's making as he tries to execute this major sort of social and political transformation of this country, is replacing Islam as a force that binds people together with nationalism. That combined with, I would say, entertaining the population with a series of sports, spectacle, gaming. You mentioned his, you know, he wants to make the kingdom a center of esports and gaming. And with the population, you know, of 65%, I think you said under 30, you know, that makes a certain amount of sense. I guess the question is, on particularly on the Islam and nationalism issue, this is still very much a tribal society, and grafting on, you know, sort of a sense of nationalism, I mean, that could be very perilous. I mean, that, whether you can make that work or not, I just wonder if you would comment on that a bit.
I think so far, young people are very happy with the changes, because many of them, like him, grew up with you know, all kinds of religious strictures, but they had the internet and they saw how the rest of the world lived, and they wanted a more liberal life, if you will, a freer life, you know, not being constantly told if you're a young man you can't go into a shopping mall without your mother, things like that, just the restrictions on people. Whether nationalism takes, I mean, he is basically saying, be a proud Saudi, we're all in this together. We're all building this. I'm not a one-man show. I need all of you. And he's very informal, completely different from previous Saudi rulers who are kind of stiff and, you know, wearing their bisht. And, you know, he rides a dirt bike. He goes to Formula One races. He puts on all kinds of, I mean, he is a young guy, and he's not stiff. And I think people, young people, appreciate that. Whether the tribalism, as you say, is really very deep. I mean, I recently met a young woman whose mother, the mother said it to me, I'd met her before, but the daughter was there, that she wants, the daughter has to marry somebody from their tribe. You know, And yet a lot of people are now, instead of having arranged marriages, they're marrying people that they meet in the office or on the internet, or it's very different. Whether a backlash comes to that, where because parents are worried that you tell your daughter you can't go out and she just shrugs and leaves. You know, that's not, and a very religious guy I used to see told me that, you know, his sons, which really shocked me because he was an extremely religious guy, that they don't listen to him. And, you know, that's not the normal behavior of young people. So whether it does spark some kind of, it's a long-winded way of saying, I don't know if it will spark a backlash, but, you know, I think he's got his work cut out for him across the board on nationalism, on making all of these giga projects actually yield jobs and revenue and be self-sustaining, because his ambitions are huge. They are now the 16th largest economy in the world, and he wants them to be, you know, in the top 10 or even 5 by 2050. He wants the Saudis to be on the moon, you know, going to Mars. I mean, they have, he has very big ambitions. And I think the young people like that, but then you have to deliver on them. And 10 years is not enough time, but another 5 or 10 from now will be, I think, a moment of truth.
You know, I have to say, listening to you, I had the mental images that kind of flit through my head are pictures of Kabul in the 60s and 70s when, you know, there were women with mini skirts wandering around, and, you know, there were a lot of very, very promising things going on, or possibly you might even compare it, I suppose, to Iran under the Shah, who was also a, you know, in his own way, a modernizer, also repressive, and a backlash. So you kind of, you worry about that. There's a lot we could talk about on the connection between religion and the kingdom. I think just for the benefit of our listeners, it's interesting to remember that, you know, the Ibn Saud was kind of using the Wahhabi fundamentalists as much as they were using him. And so it's been more of a partnership. I was wondering if you could talk about something. I think one of the great things about the book is, on the one, you're very clear about the parts of his character, which are quite admirable. He's approachable. He's very direct. He's ambitious for his country. And, you know, that there's some that's very appealing. So that's the good part. The bad part is he's very tough. There was that episode where he had, you know, all of his uncles and cousins and whatnot locked in the Ritz-Carlton and shaken down, some of them released, some of them not released. And then, of course, the really ugly, which is things like the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. And I think one of the things I would really be curious to hear you talk about would be, how do you put the composite together? Because there are so many facets to, again, somebody who's relatively young, and what, how old is he now, 39 or something like that?
39.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, how do you, what is your composite picture? Or is this a divided personality in some way?
If you've been thinking about getting serious with your money, like actually serious, now's the time. The Motley Fool is offering new members 50% off their iconic stock recommendation service, Stock Advisor. This is the same service that's crushed the market with recommendations that have returned 1,057% since inception, compared to the S&P 500's 180% over that same period. This isn't guesswork. The Motley Fool has a track record of finding companies before they become household names. So if you want to invest smarter and you like saving money while doing it, go to fool.com/listen to claim your 50% off discount off a 1-year term of Stock Advisor. Again, that's fool.com/listen. Returns of 1,057% are from the Motley Fool's product stock advisor and measured against S&P 500 returns of 180% as of July 10th, 2025. Past performance is not an indicator of future results. All investing involves a risk of loss. Individual investment results may vary.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
I mean, I think it's all, if you will, in him. I think it blends, you know, that his view is, I am, first priority is preserving the royal family in Saudi Arabia. And just like Lee Kuan Yew, I don't care about democracy. I don't care about individual rights. I care about advancing the country. I mean, Lee Kuan Yew was very, I knew him really well because he banned the Wall Street Journal in Asia, and I was supposed to go talk to him. I already knew him, but I went to talk to him about, you know, why don't you let us circulate again? And he said, I said, we circulate in China. He said, yeah, but their people can't read you. My people can, you know, so he didn't give an inch. But I think, you know, he was very candid about, I am here to, for the greater good of all people, not if I step on the rights of some individual for the greater good, so be it. And I think that's the way MBS looks at, if I have to deal with, I never saw any evidence that Jamal Khashoggi was disloyal. I mean, they alleged he was on the payroll of Qatar, but, and maybe he was, I don't know. But, you know, I also have found out that my translator for the first book apparently was executed last year. And he was, you know, he was definitely not anybody who was anti-royal family. So I, it's very troubling. But I think in him, he believes that it fits together, that he is like a lot of other, as I, in the last chapter of the book, sort of look at other young people, people who got power young and had it for a long time. So Peter the Great, a big modernizer, he killed his own son. Augustus gouged out the eyes of, I mean, he was very cruel in the beginning of his reign, and then he allowed political freedom and, you know, became much, as George Bush would say, kinder, gentler. So I think if you are an autocrat, you believe that you have the right. I mean, look at Donald Trump. He believes, I think, that he has the right to do what he chooses to do. And he's an elected official. So if you're a hereditary monarch in a family that's run the country off and on for 300 years, I mean, I'm not excusing all of these things, but I think for him, I don't think it is a, you know, this kind of bifurcated thing. I think it's, I'm here to advance my country, and, you know, I don't have time for the little stuff. I'm willing to jump in and take a risk.
You know, that's maybe a good point at which to talk about the intersection of what he is doing in the kingdom with the United States and U.S. policy. So you talk in the book quite a bit about the Biden administration and its policies towards the kingdom. And, you know, Biden, when he campaigned in 2020, said that, you know, the MBS should be treated like a pariah, and that Saudi Arabia should be treated like a pariah state, and that, you know, a new administration, if he came into power, would come down on the kingdom like a ton of bricks. When he actually came into office, he kind of executed that in a sense, because he published a very thinly redacted intelligence estimate of the Crown Prince's purported role in the assassination of Khashoggi. In my view of that was, there was no new information in it, and it served no real purpose other than to, you know, kind of inflame, you know, U.S.-Saudi relations. But in very short order, you know, the Biden administration discovered that if it wanted to try and tamp down oil prices, which were a matter of domestic political concern to the Biden folk in 2022, they needed the help of the kingdom. And they needed the help of the kingdom on other fronts as well, in terms of their China policy and various other things that they were trying to accomplish. I mean, and it highlights something you talk about, which is the kingdom's role in MBS's mind as a important middle power, or what Paul Kennedy at Yale calls the pivotal states in the global system, in a world of great power competitors. Now we've got sort of Trump back, which I think MBS welcomed, in part because in the first Trump term, there really was a family-to-family relationship. It really was the Al Saud family and the Trump family, and that was all kind of mediated through Jared Kushner, who doesn't have quite the same role at all that he had in the first term. But still, you know, there's clearly a family-to-family connection there. Trump made his first foreign visit to, in his first term, to Saudi Arabia. He did go to Rome for the Pope's funeral, but that, you know, that was just a kind of came up out of nowhere. But it was not intended to be the first trip. Intended to be the first trip was Saudi Arabia again. So can you comment a little bit about how this is all playing out in U.S.-Saudi relations, both with the Biden people and now again with the Trump administration?
Well, I think the Biden people made a terrible mistake. I mean, the Saudis are willing to forgive anything you say during a political campaign because, you know, the foreign minister and people like that understand American political campaigns. They just don't expect you to keep it up once you're in power. So Biden found himself, as I said in the book, being humbled by the prince that he intended to humble, because when he asked for more oil production, MBS just said no. I think, you know, Trump disappointed them greatly in the first administration after when the Iranians hit the Saudi oil facility, and the U.S. did nothing. That shook them. I think they are happy to see Trump back over Kamala Harris, but I can't imagine that they trust Trump, even though he did strike Iran, strike the nuclear facilities, and that shows that he is willing occasionally to use force, but he talks so much about not wanting to do it and about, you know, being a peacemaker. So I don't see any diminution in the Crown Prince playing that middle power role between the U.S., China, Russia, because he needs Russia to control oil prices by keeping production up or down. And China is the biggest customer of Saudi oil. So both of those countries, they have to be polite and even friendly with. And they obviously see the U.S. as the only country that could really save them in an emergency if Iran were after them or terrorists in the kingdom or whatever. But they don't know if the U.S. would really do it. And I think that that causes them a lot of pause. And of course, Trump is a one-term president, and soon there will be someone else. You know, the advantage for MBS is he's been there for 10 years and he could be there for another 50. And we change every 4 to 8 years, so it's hard to get a real consistent relationship.
This carries you a little bit beyond the book, but I was wondering, you finished the book, obviously, before the latest bout of fighting between Iran and Israel, with the very dramatic Israeli successes. And then, of course, we actually strike a number of Iranian nuclear targets. Do you think that's changed the Saudi basic sort of geopolitical and strategic assessment of where they are? Or do you think that, that's just kind of a surface phenomenon from their point of view, that the basic geometry remains the same, that you need the Americans for security, but you can't really alienate the Russians or the Chinese, and the Iranians are a really big threat besides their schismatics, so you can't trust them anyway, but you can't, neither can you really go all out in terms of conflict with them. How has the geometry changed at all, do you think, from their point of view?
I want to make clear that I have not obviously seen the Crown Prince. I haven't been there since March to Saudi Arabia since March of this year, and all of this postdates that. So, you know, while you talk to some people, I can't say I have any, but my suspicion would be that it doesn't change the fundamental geometry. Because I think, you know, the Crown Prince started out in powers comparing Khamenei to Hitler. And isolating, breaking relations with Qatar in, you know, the war in Yemen, and being punching with both fists. And he decided that wasn't working that well, or he told me in March of 23, I'm going to restore diplomatic relations with Iran. And which shocked me, because I thought they were very nervous about Iran, and they are, and he acknowledged they are. But the reason is that the U.S. Didn't look like it intended to take control of Iran, that we were continuing to negotiate all of this obvious useless drivel. So he made his peace with Iran, not because they trust him at all, but because the Iranians were in bad shape and would do it, and it was better to be to have the relationship. Now that Iran is so much weakened, I'm sure that pleases them greatly. But Iran is far from finished. I mean, it may change, but it may not. And they have to constantly fear any kind of terrorism. They haven't had incidents in the country, but you can't mark it off as something that will never happen. So I think that the fundamental geometry still is, they would love to have a strong relationship with the U.S., a trustworthy U.S., and that's why they wanted this, defense treaty. but I don't see how that gets through the Senate if it's negotiated. And I'm not sure why you would believe it. I mean, we have a defense treaty with NATO, but, you know, Trump just basically told him, I don't have any use for you anymore. And he's walking that back some. But anyway, I think they would like a very ironclad relationship with the U.S., but despite the 80-long-year relationship since FDR and Abdulaziz, I don't see them getting what they really want there. So I don't see them in any way isolating, you know, Russia or China, and continuing to try to deal with Europe. I think it makes MBS feel that he's punching above his weight. I mean, the Saudis have always been more quiet, as you know, diplomatically, not out there. And he's not out there as much as I think he would need to be if he really wants to get a lot of things done. I don't think the fundamental calculus has changed. Do you?
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
You know, you know far more than I do. I tend to agree with you. I mean, I think there is this sort of general problem now that people of trust in the United States, I mean, particularly after the Saudis, but also the Emiratis, you know, have experienced all kinds of attacks where they could have reasonably expected that, you know, we'd at least be doing things like rushing Patriot missiles and stuff to their defense. We completely dropped the ball on that. And I don't think you get trust back very quickly. I think you'd have to have several administrations worth. I am struck by one thing, which is the Europeans just don't seem to be in this game at all. I mean, it's the United States, it's China, it's Russia, it's Iran, it's Israel. And, you know, nobody thinks about the British or French really in this context. And there was a piece recently, may actually have been in the Wall Street Journal, about how completely ineffective the Europeans have been in securing the Red Sea against the Houthis. You know, they have a fair amount of maritime traffic that goes through the Suez Canal. I mean, it's a testament to how much they've disarmed. So that really does strike me.
Once upon a time, they launched a war because of lack of access to the Suez Canal, but that was long ago in a universe far away.
Back under Eisenhower, right?
Only the three of us remember that because we're of a certain.
Yes, only the three of us remember, right?
Karen, I wonder, you know, in the absence of a U.S. security guarantee, you know, the question of how they play this, there are two elements to it. You know, one is kind of the China element. You pointed out that China is their biggest customer right now. One of the things that I thought was completely miscalculated by the Biden people, you know, as you know, once they did a 180 on Saudi Arabia, then all of a sudden it was this sort of headlong pursuit of a defense treaty, some kind of undertaking by the Saudis that they would be on our side, not China's side. And I never quite understood how the Biden people thought they were going to memorialize that or codify that in any kind of meaningful way. And then there was also the business of, a 1-2-3 agreement under the Atomic Energy Act for nuclear cooperation. And so, you know, if they can't have the security guarantee from the U.S., and like you, I find it hard to imagine the United States Senate ratifying a treaty that says, yes, you know, yea, verily, the United States is prepared to, you know, militarily come to the aid of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and shed blood for it if, you know, if something happens in the region. So I just don't see that in the cards. So if that doesn't happen, then what do they do? Do they just try and balance? I mean, traditionally, they've tried to balance all, you know, outside powers, you know, on the peninsula. Or do they go for a nuclear capability of their own? I mean, is that the ultimate, you know, if they don't see anybody stepping in to really stop the Iranian program? And the Iranian program has been set back by some number of years. But, you know, unless, in my view, unless there's some kind of change in the leadership, it'll only be a matter of time before they're back at it. So how do they play that, do you think?
I mean, what everybody has always told me in my 40, well, not the 40 plus, but in the last 20 years of going there, is that, you know, the Saudis paid for the development of the Pakistani bomb. When they want it, they will snap their fingers and get it, that they don't need to go into creating a nuclear program, that they want to enrich their uranium to sell to other people because they have 6 or 7% of the world's uranium, and it's one of the new minerals, new ways of making money beyond oil is tourism, sports events, minerals, and that one of those is uranium. And so they do want the capability, but they have no interest. And I don't think there's anybody in Israel that is frightened of a Saudi nuclear enrichment program because they don't think the Saudis want a bomb, largely for the same reasons that if they want it, they'll get it from Pakistan.
You know, I seem to remember that, was it 1986 that they bought 50 Chinese surface-to-surface missiles?
Silkworm. And,
which at one level seems not to make any sense unless the Pakistani warhead design is essentially a Chinese design and it would be fairly easy to make to the missiles. And that was my understanding of it. You know, the one other thing which, you know, you talk about in the book, which I thought very interesting, that they have a very strong covert relationship with the Israelis in terms of intelligence sharing, probably allowing Israeli overflight. So I wouldn't be surprised that that's probably one of the insurance policies they have. And now it's not like having the United States being a reliable partner, but you know, that is an interesting connection.
And as you point out, Karen, I think in the book, the one time that they've put those Chinese Silkworm missiles on display was in 2018 after the Abqaiq attack and no U.S. response, which certainly signaled, you know, a couple of things, you know, about their willingness to do business with the Chinese and potentially go their own way on nuclear weapons as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I remember when Prince Bandar went to China to do that deal, apparently. And then when George Shultz found out about it, I'm told that he was rather outraged. And, you know, Bandar explained that to me at one point, and I said, geez, you know, how do you expect Shultz to ever trust you again? You know, I mean, I guess that's the way people treat each other when you're, you know, in a high government position. But it seems to me your word has to mean something, you know, but he was something else, as I'm sure you know. Always fun to talk to. Do either of you, can I ask one of the things, either of you think the Iranian regime is likely to change? I mean, if we keep putting pressure on, are we actually put pressure on, or will they just, the Russians will help them? And
you know, the Russians didn't do very much to lift a finger.
Exactly.
And nor do the Chinese, for that matter, although I think both will now try and take advantage of the Iranian losses by stepping in and replacing them for hard, cold cash. My sense is of the regime, and I'm not an Iranist, but I do on occasion write with Ray Takei of the Council on Foreign Relations, who is. And my sense is these regimes are always, they look very strong until they're not. And this regime clearly is very fearful of the public and is cracking down big time. Its paranoia has been deeply increased by the degree of penetration that the Israelis have demonstrated through a variety of attacks that they've executed on senior leaders in Iran. And I don't know at what point there will be a break, but it is certainly a tradition in Iran going back to the early 20th century for public eruptions to lead to regime change. That happened in 1906 with the Constitutional Revolution. It happened in the 20s when Reza Shah, put himself on the throne at the head of a popular uprising. It happened to some degree in 1953. I think we tend to misremember that because of all the emphasis on the CIA covert action, a lot of which, in my view, was sort of self-congratulatory on the part of folks at CIA, when in fact, and this is something that the current regime doesn't like to point out, but a major part of the popular uprising against Mossadegh was actually led by the clergy, who were opposed to his secularism and his socialism. So, and obviously it happened in 1979 when Reza Shah Pahlavi was overthrown. It's hard to make a prediction, but I think that they're living on borrowed time.
So I just have two angles. One, I remember talking to a student of mine who happened to be in Tehran in 2009, I guess, when they had those mass demonstrations. And the thing that he said really struck him, it's still not entirely clear to me what he was doing there, but what struck him was the amount of Chinese equipment that the forces of order had. And so I think one big question that has to go, I think, for any authoritarian regime these days is, to what extent are they getting Chinese help, in terms of kit, but also facial recognition software, the techne of repression, and which I think mitigates a little bit against the idea that you can, you'll just have a upheaval like the one that, I don't know, overthrew the Ceausescu's, what have you. But I think that, the point of maximum vulnerability has to be when Khamenei dies. And when you have a succession that may be contested, it's not entirely clear. I think it seems to me it's more likely to be the pathway for these kinds of authoritarian regimes. It's when you have a succession crisis and who knows who comes to the top and what they are like. And in a way, that's, I suppose, the story of your book. You didn't expect MBS to, show up in this way. Well, maybe something happens in Iran.
In that first book said, that they had this risk of being like the old Soviet Union, but they still had time and they had a lot of money to buy stents and do surgery. But was there a daring doctor who could do the surgery? And, I named a few younger people, but, I did not. MBS in 2012 was 27 or something, 20 younger. But I think he is the daring doctor. Whether he does like, Peter the Great thought he was a doctor, if you recall, and did surgery on some of his people. Whether he's a skilled surgeon and all of these things work out. But I think having somebody with the willingness to try is good for the country. So all of his flaws and all of his charm, and I put the whole thing together and stir it around and say there is a intelligence and courage and a runway long enough to actually do something So he may succeed. It's obviously possible that something happens, and we in America, because religion is kind of something nobody seems to care about in this country, you know, don't think it matters. But there are, as you're talking about Iran, Eric, but it's true in Saudi Arabia. It's still a tribal and still a conservative country. And all of those people who tried to propagate religion on everyone, they're still somewhere. Some of them are dying off, perhaps, but you can't, I think, assume that religion in both Saudi Arabia and Iran is irrelevant.
Well, we're coming to the end of our time, but this has been a fascinating conversation. Our guest has been Karen Elliott House, who is the author of The Man Who Would Be King. I commend it to all of our listeners and viewers. It will make you a lot smarter about a very important country that figures not only in the fate of the Middle East, but the future of international affairs. So, Karen, thank you for joining us. And I hope we can have you back from time to time to, as we take the temperature on how MBS is doing.
Okay. I really appreciate, Eric, both you and Elliott doing this. I enjoy the conversation very much. So thank you.